Italian Wine Podcast. Cin Cin with Italian Wine People.
Hello, this is the Italian Wine Podcast. My name is Monty Warden. My guest today is Richard Kershaw, Master of Wine. What are you doing? What's that face you're doing?
I've no idea.
It's already degenerated. I've known Richard for about, how long is it? 30
it's
years?
It's actually probably 23 years.
Feels like a century, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yes. Yeah,
I don't know how we're still friends, really.
No, yeah. I didn't know we were.
Or even how you passed the Master of Wine. That was how much money, how many suitcases of greenbacks did that cost you to get?
An enormous amount, and given the inflation, given the Brexit situation.
South
even
America,
more.
Peru,
it was Peruvian gold, generally.
Panama, I thought so. Pretty. So you're obviously quite sharp.
Very sharp, indeed.
That obviously helped.
One of the sharpest pins there.
Yeah, well, in a box with only one pin in, so, you know, not surprising.
Indeed.
Anyway, so moving swiftly on, the Master of Wine. When did you become a Master of Wine, Richard?
It was back in the 2011 vintage.
Right.
And it was actually not at my first attempt, but when we had a little go at it back in the days.
In the 1990s.
Where it's very British orientated. I didn't get anywhere with it, and I decided to cut it all in and throw it all in and start making wine. And then only
So you're doing the Master of Wine in England.
Yeah.
Didn't work out.
Yeah.
Got fed up.
Yeah.
And why did you move to South Africa?
Actually, part of the reason I got fed up was that the company I was working for at this particular time had decided that wasn't, Master of Wine wasn't something high on their agenda.
They also said you're pretty crap at your job as well, if I remember. But
No, I don't remember that. But the main premise was that I'm not going to stay around if that's the case. Leave the job, travel the world, spend the money that I don't have on things I don't need, but at least explore the wine regions and make a bit of wine in the meantime. Get paid in pesos, which basically are nothing. And effectively try and get some sort of idea of becoming a Master of Wine. That was my first sort of inkling, and that's what I did until 96, when I decided to kind of jack it in and start to actually concentrate more on a winemaking career.
So you felt that actually being a winemaker would help you pass part of the exam, basically?
I did, yes. I felt during the study time when I was researching my first dissertation that traveling between the various wine regions of the world, I felt an active and deeper knowledge of winemaking was essential. Otherwise, you were just merely a sort of peripheral player, or you were never really going to get to the nuts and bolts, especially given the fact that the complexity of wine isn't just in sort of quality wine regions, it's throughout all wine regions.
Did you manage to spend any time in Italy, or was that off the radar at the time?
At the time, it was a little off the radar.
Was that a language barrier?
Well, I spent time in Portugal, although there's a lot of English gentry there, and certainly was when we were there.
Come to Tuscany, mate. It's full of English gentry.
Well, that's true. I should have maybe come. Maybe I should have known. But no, actually at the time, it was mostly sort of Spain, Portugal, and North America, as well as parts of France.
Okay, so Italy wasn't really on the radar.
Unfortunately not, no.
So now you're in Elgin. Where is that in South Africa, making wine?
Well, about an hour east of Cape Town, or east-southeast of Cape Town.
On the coast?
It's right on the coast, yeah. We're about 11 kilometres from the sea, and we're surrounded by mountains, so 11 kilometres up a hill and then down the hill. And one of the coolest climate in South Africa, so interesting area.
Why is it so cool?
Largely, altitude is partly responsible. It's a little bit higher than most, 300 to 550, 600 meters.
It's quite high, isn't it?
Yeah.
Relatively
so. And obviously proximity to sea. Also, mostly because we get a lot of rainfall due to our mountain. We're surrounded by mountains.
So it's like a rain trap.
It's a little bit of a rain trap and a cloud map trap. So a lot less UV light radiation and so on and so forth, which gives us a little bit less... longer time to ripen our grapes, and therefore more challenging for certain varieties.
And do you irrigate then if it's rainy?
Well, actually, looking at all the analysis, and we could get very geeky here, but
we
the
like
actual
geeks.
Seasonal.
That's why we got you on the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For the simple thing is that the actual rainfall is such that we get enough rainfall and we get less seasonal evaporation due to slightly higher humidity or vapor pressure deficit figures, to get more precise. We shouldn't need to actually irrigate at all, and in many cases we don't. However, due to the fact that the farmers that planted the vineyards in the first place were apple derived, because all the farmers in Elgin originally were apple farmers, they tended to go for irrigation simply because apples need irrigation, so they assumed they would. Right. But a number of times we don't use actually any irrigation water.
So if you're saying it's obviously a South Africa, pretty hot place, but you're in a cool climate in a hot area, hot place essentially.
Mm.
What is the scope there in your particular region for Italian wine varietals, do you think? or do you have to move further inland to the warmer climes?
I think certain varieties could work extremely well, and in our little region, which it is little, only 800 hectares planted.
Tiny.
There is a little bit of Nebbiolo planted as in regards to Italy, and Nebbiolo is also seen in Constantia as a variety that's worked quite well, for example, with Steenberg.
So where's Constantia?
That's towards the southern peninsula, so south of Cape Town by about half an hour.
Is that and much warmer there then, or not?
It's a coolish climate, but it's warmer than Elgin.
And what are the Nebbiolos like? Are they sort of aromatic? Are they Italianized, or are they New Worldy, or how would you describe them?
At this point, I would say my problem with a lot of the Nebbiolos is they're slightly more modernized, clearly because of the market they're selling them to. They do get the aromaticity, which is great. But they don't quite get the firmness of tannins and the density. But there is some good tannin density in some of the wines. So you can see there's clearly a possibility. And obviously, clearly with older vines and maybe other areas, maybe Elgin could work. We certainly get a lot of cloud cover in Elgin, and we get a lot of mist. And maybe, who knows, that could have a tie-in, a romantic tie-in.
What about the Swartland, which is a kind of hot, in both senses? It's trendy, very trendy area, a lot of old vines, bush vines.
Yeah.
And when you go to that and schisty soil, when you go there, you kind of do think, it reminds you of southern Italy, very arid place. Do you think there's scope there for southern Italian varieties, I say like Primitivo or Aglianico or things like that?
I think definitely Primitivo or Zinfandel, and certainly Aglianico could work extremely well. At the moment, there's a huge focus clearly on the Spanish style, so Mourvedres, Grenache or Garnacha, and there's a leaning towards that simply because of the heat, I suppose the dryness, the lack of humidity and lack of rainfall. So at this point, there's nothing really more Italianized. And to be fair, a lot of that is derived from vines that are old. So at this point, hasn't been a lot of old Italian varietals planted to give them, or varietals planted that have age.
So how easy, if I'm a wine, or you're a winemaker and you want to import some cuttings,
yeah,
of, for example, any Sangiovese, for example, how easy is it to get those into South Africa, obeying all the regulations that you would need to export from Italy and to import into South Africa?
It's about a 5-year quarantine period.
Really?
So actually, from start to finish, as getting it and then actually planting it.
Have you tried?
I haven't tried, but I do know this actually more in relation to clones for Pinot Noir.
Right.
That's been a more, it's a roughly the sort of lead time, but it's very possible and they're very much open to it. What is interesting though is that actually of the 152 authorized varieties in South Africa, there is actually only 94 planted. So clearly there are a lot of varieties that are available but just aren't being planted.
Right. So when you say available, you mean that cuttings are in the country?
They are cuttings.
Legally, they're legally there.
Yeah, they're legally there. They're legally available, just that people haven't picked them up. So if you look at Italian varieties, I know Vermentino, for example, I don't think it's been planted particularly at all. I know there's, I think, Verdicchio, some of the white Italian varietals. I'm not quite sure on the reds, but I'm sure there are a number of varieties that are, well, clearly there are a number. That's a third of the entire amount unplanted.
Right. In terms of Italian culture in, I don't know, say, for example, Cape Town, are there little Italian areas there or Spanish areas, or is it very kind of just South African and international? How
Greek.
Does it work?
Is it Greek. There's a lot of Greek areas. Actually, in fairness, there are definitely Italian pockets and there are definitely wineries which have Italian influences. Because obviously on the other side, I mean, I'm not just talking about grapes, olives in particular. There's a large amount of olives planting and there's a large amount of Italian influence. Morgenster, there's Costa. Idiom actually has a lot of Italian influence.
So who are they? They olive oil producers.
They've been olive oil producers, or they've started up a winery on the back of that for their primary industry. And others are just basically interested in Italian varieties. There is a definite, that Italians have tended to be good emigres. So we do see them in the Cape, as we do in Joburg. But no, there's definitely interest. I think possibly the issue that South Africa struggles with a little bit is identification of where its regions can produce the best grape varieties. And that lack of focus has often meant that the international grape varieties have come first. And from that, and now, or rather right now, is there is a definite upswing in trying to plant some of the more esoteric grape varieties, or even just less known. I mean, some of them aren't that esoteric at all. They just need to they need a wider audience. But unfortunately, you've got a local market that clearly needs to be tapped into to generate that wider performance. Pinot Grigio is a good example as a widely planted grape variety. It's done extremely well in other areas outside of Italy, but you struggle to find it in South Africa, and it could easily be a perfect foil for a great many dishes, but importantly could be a difference to, say, Chenin Blanc and Sauvignon, which is almost ubiquitous in its shelf space in all of South Africa.
And what about exports of South African wine in general? Where are the main markets? Just see where the market is going. What the potential competition for Italian wine in other markets?
Well, I mean, in terms of South Africa, the main market's always been the UK, possibly because they're tie-in, Holland because of the Dutch connection. The American market has been tapped into to an extent, or tried to be tapped into time and time again, with little or no success. But
why not? Why is it so difficult?
I think generally financial issues, just the cost of actually trying to get into the market.
Okay.
Wodra is not government funded. The government is anti-alcohol and tries with its every, especially because it's that there's perceived white monopolists, white capitalists, sort of running the farms. That there's always been an issue with that.
And also there are issues with consumption, as in poorer people.
There's an extent, yes, to an extent, but a much lesser extent, I would say. But the thing is that America has started to change, and I think also one has to remember that in America there has been a general change from sort of east to west coast, as that market itself has also started to become more open-minded about A, imported wines, and B, South African wines. I know it sounds ridiculous. Geography plays a huge part. I think Australia...
That's right, you're so far away.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talk about Australia being quite an exciting country when it arrived in England, because it was literally on the other side of the world. For America, South Africa is really on the other side of the world. It's a difficult place to get to. So in a way, I think geography does play a part. Europe's a lot easier to get to, even though it's in the same time zone. So I think that's where the market has tended to concentrate. Although of late, there has been definite movement in the Chinese market, and interestingly, more recently, Japan.
Okay. So you are a master of wine.
Yes.
When did you pass?
2011.
And you are sort of on the education committee and all the rest of it. Yeah, you're quite
I have an active role.
Quite a grand fromage, a big cheese in the master of wine. When students are studying, Italian wine is often seen as very complicated, with all these ridiculous amount of native grape varieties with complicated names and synonyms and all the rest of it. What is the approach of the Institute to teaching about Italian wine?
Well, actually, I think the initial approach is, of course, the Institute is not a teaching establishment.
Oh, of course.
It's an establishment in which you, as the student, should be coming in fully armed with your knowledge from your diploma or equivalent of.
So all the geeky stuff like, you know, the maximum amount, minimum amount of Sangiovese and Chianti Classico,
exactly.
All that sort of thing.
Okay. You should have all that knowledge already under your belt.
The basics.
I think the essential teaching, though, is that from a Master of Wine perspective, you are, and increasingly because of the homogeneity that's sort of been created over the last 20 years, there is a tendency to focus on the classics.
So Sangiovese, Nebbiolo, Aglianico, things like that.
Absolutely. And sort of areas where there is a perceived difference, because tasting blind is often more challenging when you've got sort of grape varieties that taste very similar to each other. However, if there are, a lot of the papers more recently in terms of practical have focused...
This is a blind tasting exam.
Sorry, yes. It's a blind tasting exam.
So three parts
There's
to it.
Three parts, 12 wines in each part.
And they are?
The first paper, 12 wines of white. Second is a red paper. And the third is essentially a mixed paper. In the past, it was often a fortified, sparkling, rosé cleanup,
really. For the mixed paper.
Now it can be almost anything you want. We've had an all red paper, which has been challenging for those students who have religiously studied for fortifieds and sparkling. But it changes every year. But in terms of the main papers, the wines from Italy would be...
Classics, would they? Like a Suave or...
Yeah, you're going to look... Barolo. In terms of white wines, red wines, yes, absolutely. You're going to be Suave, you're going to be in the Piedmont area, you're going to be in Tuscany, and you're going to be... asked to know those sorts of areas and differentiate between your Chiantis and your Brunellos. And
so what's the typical question? And so you have four, just say there's four reds, and they say of these four reds, they're all the same variety. How does it work? Give us a typical question. Imagine they say four Sangiovese. What would the question be? How would it be phrased?
Well, actually, the thing is that, sorry, what I was really going to, what was I going to say before I was rudely interrupted?
I get fine. Every time I interrupt people, I have to pay a 10 euro fine.
Something like that, yeah.
To after 1,000 euros in this one.
Yeah. Actually, the thing is that the questions are very different now, because when we first had a go at this back in the 90s, you would get sort of four varieties, or you would more likely get four wines which are all from Italy, and you would then be there asked to differentiate between what you thought they were.
And these four wines are all from one country.
One country.
Name the country. Give your reasons wine? What are the great varieties?
And as diligent students, we would immediately pick up the Barolo without any problem, the Chianti with a little bit more problems, but probably pick it up. And we'd probably pick up whatever, maybe a Southern Italian wine. And then we'd maybe struggle with a sort of rather international Bulgari Cabernet Merlot wine. But we'd go there because that would be our sort of our ringer for the four. Now there's a little bit more accent on maybe showing four wines from Piedmont and focusing more on the vintages.
Right.
And more importantly, that the question that might arise is that you might get more unusual grapes. So in fact, you wouldn't get a lineup of, say, four Italians. You might get a lineup of two wines, say, from Nerello Mascarese or something like that, where you are asked really, where do they fit in the market? What's the commercial appeal?
Right.
What sort of outlets they would be sold in? So in a way, a more generalized outlook. And your job would be then to describe the style and all the other characteristics. Because even if you didn't get it as a sort of a Sicilian wine, at least you were pretty close to what it was. Because that makes it, because there are a number of wines from those sorts of areas.
So right, I've just given you Nerello Mascalese. In the, what market would that be going into? Give me your reasons why, three reasons on the spot. Off you go, bam.
But clearly a nice sort of, aromatic volcanic soil variety that produces some, nice gritty tannins that in a market such as a developed market, mature market, where they're interested, young millennials are interested in something perhaps not with any wood or lashings of oak, something that's available at a reasonable price at a wine bar, say in London or New York, that would be absolutely up their street. Something to go with a nice sort of interesting sort of soft curry, something that, something like that. That would be my kind of, that's where I'd be fitting in. And it's interesting and affordable. I think, one has to remember one of the challenges of the modern wine world is that, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, we could still afford first growths. Now they are just distant thoughts. And if we do we really want to try, what can become slightly ubiquitous in Bordeaux with various techniques to make similar homogenized wines. So actually, in a way, the young generation is clamoring for these volcanic styles and different styles from areas like, say, Etna or wherever, that I think are very affordable and interesting.
Do you think, Italian wine, Italy has about 75,000 different denominations and billions of native grape varieties. Is it, when you open the sort of study book as a master wine, you think, I just can't do this. It's just impossible. That's just one country. I'm absolutely...
Well, I think actually, going back to my earlier point, there isn't a study book at all.
Oh, I know.
Because one is supposed to know. But when you open the diploma study book, the indigenous varieties take more and more space. And clearly, the Master of Wine program is very much a snapshot in time. You are going to be judged doing the exam on the wines that are in current vogue. So again, when we had a go 20 years ago, Bulgaria actually had a part to play. So we tended to know our Plovdivs and so on and so forth. Now that's not actually something that's that relevant. However, we all know our Etna wines now far better than we ever used to, but we will delve further into the sort of outer reaches of Puglia and probably unearth new varieties, but indigenous varieties that had no real interest and now start to become interesting. Santorini, in Greece has started to become an interesting, everybody's planting Assyrtiko, we have actually in South Africa. I think the future is of anything like a study group is to be up and current with the education program and show the wines that are relevant to the audience, because that's really where your mastery in wine is going to come out of, rather than sort of stick to the stodgy. However, having said that, the classics are still there, and we still do pay huge amounts of wine for Burgundy and so on and so forth, which we still clearly need to know, even if we have to take a second mortgage.
So how do you think the most expensive, like the Barolos and the Brunellos, stack up internationally? Not as a master wine, but just as a wine drinker?
As a wine drinker, and bearing in mind I live on the other side of the world, so technically it's harder to get these wines. I have a stash full of Italian wines more than any other region.
Oh, now you're running out of tape. we've got like 2 minutes left. Go on.
Well, I have a stash full of wines. I think mostly because I still think the value of those wines are still remarkably good.
So go on, what's in the cupboard? Go on, tell us.
What's in the cupboard? Okay, the classic. A lot of Piedmont wines, to be fair with you.
Such as
the Gaias and the Aldo Canternos and Sandrones. And I know a little bit modern for those likes. But and then a bit of Scavino here and there and whatever and so on and so forth. And then
anything from southern Italy? Or are you a northern Italian snob?
It's actually I'm not
only bad if it's from Piemonte.
No, actually, quite a lot of Brunellos And now you're going to ask me, I can't remember the names, quite a few, but they're expensive, as you know. And then actually quite a few wines from, you know, Sicily as well.
You quite like Sicily, don't you? You mentioned about 85 times.
I have mentioned it 85 times.
Volcanic
soil. Sorry, yes, yeah. I know. I will immediately desist.
That's become really on trend, hasn't it, the volcanic thing?
I think so. I think you could argue that New Zealand never really pushed it, but they always had volcanic soils for their Sauvignon that made them so eminently drinkable.
We'll cut that bit out.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, Kiwi.
Sorry, I don't even know where New Zealand is, actually.
Yeah. It's another Kiwi podcast. You know. Buddy Kiwis go everywhere. Anyway, have we missed anything?
Obviously, we're not on radio, so we can't yarn about how attractive I am.
No, but also, we would get taken to court in any of the stories that we would tell, so we really don't want them. I don't have a really particularly good lawyer. I'm sure you do, earning millions in Elgin. Anyway, Richard Kershaw, Master of Wine and Bon Vivant. Bon Viveur, with his stash of Brunello in his cupboard that he just had to let everybody know about.
Exactly.
Well, great to see you after so many years. Congratulations again on becoming Master of Wine. You are a very enthusiastic chap and just the kind of person that the Master of Wine need. Some of those stuffy, crusty, very aged old fogies that used to run it. And you're not one of those. And you don't cut that out, please, Julia. Keep it in. It's great to see people like you coming through and your enthusiasm and willingness to share your knowledge. Your very deep knowledge with the students. Well done. Thanks, Richard.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Follow Italian Wine Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.